generally how I begin these interviews is I ask people to tell us a little bit about their background. Your background is very well defined, so I'm going to ask you a specific thing, and I think you mentioned this in Philadelphia, is when did you first get interested in the concept of fiduciary, and what attracted you most to the idea?
Well, as I said in my talk, that was 1951, was inspired by an article at the end of 1949 in Fortune called Big Money in Boston. And I mentioned fiduciary duty in that thesis. Wasn't quite on the mark of maybe the way we talk about it today. But I also made the point in that thesis, the overall theme of my thesis, Princeton thesis, 125 pages or something, was the mutual fund shareholder must come first, and then that is a certain kind of definition of fiduciary duty. So the words are there, but even more importantly, the idea was in that thesis all those years ago. So it starts in 1951, and much more to the point, you saw this in the written speech. I think I read most of this when I was speaking to you, and it's a quote I used. It was an interesting point. I had a challenge of fiduciary duty in the lecture I was giving, or a year-end speech, to our employees and partners, I guess just the partners of Wellington Management Company. And Wellington Management Company was a public, this is 1971.
Right.
And I really hit it over the head in 1971, quoting from Justice Harlan Fiske-Stone, that's on page 2. And then particularly revealed the real problem I have, despite the fact we're a publicly held management company, of public ownership, and it got even worse after 1971, public stockholders, because mutual funds started to be taken over by mutual fund managers, starting to be bought by financial conglomerates. So you got this giant owner who calls the shots. And if he buys a mutual fund management company for, let me say, $1 billion, he wants to take out $150 to $200 million a year in profits. That's the return on his investment. So it doesn't work. And today, probably back in 1971 when I was worried about this, let me guess that there were a dozen mutual fund management companies. They were owned by the public. Conglomeration had not really started. But today, 40 of the 50 largest mutual fund companies are owned by the public. About 35 by financial conglomerates, 5 are publicly held. Something like that. I can get that number for you a little more exactly if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
So the industry has gone in the wrong direction ever since it became possible to sell your fiduciary duty. Supreme Court decision that was made back in 1958. The California court allowed this to go on. Company long gone. And the Supreme Court did not review. So we have this industry that has an incorrect structure, a structure that does not work for the investor. And so that's where it begins. And I've had, if you look a number of times, it said fiduciary or fiduciary duty or fiduciary standard in my speeches, in which there are 500 or so. You'll probably find it in there.
Right.
Let me say 250 times.
Okay. Why do you think it took so long for everybody to get on board with this?
Well, first, it's complicated. It's easy to write, but the Department of Labor release must be, I think it's 150 pages or 200 pages. It's complicated. It involves record keeping. It involves, at least for stockbrokers, a whole new way of thinking about things. And also, having come out of the Labor Department, which I salute them for doing. I mean, I had a great time with Phyllis Borzi that night,
mm-hmm.
and that day. And she's a wonderful person, a kind of public servant we need everywhere here. But the reality is that it's complicated. I used to talk to the executives, the people that ran the Investment Company Institute. I said, we need a federal statute of fiduciary duty. They said, we are fiduciaries. And And I would say to them, well, are you fiduciaries for the fund shareholders or for the management company shareholders? Go figure that. It's an absolute conflict of interest. And that will ultimately require this industry to change, and change radically. There's no question about that. And the most important message in that speech, I think, Chris, was that, okay, you know, you're not going to be able to take this fiduciary thing any further. And I said, in effect, overstating here, obviously.
Right.
So what? As long as the consumer gets educated, and they get more educated every single day, managers will have to toe the line. They will have to act as if they're putting the client first, which is a definition of fiduciary duty.
Right.
In other words, if your clients leave you unless you conform, you're not going to be in business very long. Clients have to put client service first. And that quote from Adam Smith that I used on page 7, and that my rewrite of the quote on Adam Smith that I used on page 7, the interest of the investor must be the ultimate end and object of the entire financial system. Of course they must be. That's the way things work. And you can fool some of the people all the time, and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. I forget this, P.T. Barnum or something.
Right, yeah. All right. Let's talk more specifically about the DOL's conflict of interest rule. You know, the one in, you know, where they expand the definition to a fiduciary and all that. The thing we talked about in Philadelphia. Why is, and I know you talked a little bit about this before, but I'm trying to pinpoint, why do you think this is so important? Which I think you've already answered that, so you could skip that part. But more importantly, how do you think the industry will respond beyond these lawsuits? And do you see any traction in these lawsuits at all? I know you're not a lawyer, but if you can give me just a general kind of feeling.
Well, you know, I spent an awful lot of time on investment company law and fiduciary law with Tamar Frankel.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So I certainly wouldn't fall back on abject ignorance.
Okay.
But sooner or later, the law requires interpretation, as I mentioned in that speech. It's really kind of amusing to think of the stockbroker who has retirement plan clients over here on in his left hand and non-retirement plan clients in his right hand. Is he really going to treat them differently? In other words, we should have a ruling on fiduciary duty, a rule on fiduciary duty come out of the SEC. But it's just absurd to think that your broker is going to handle your retirement account for you in a little red file, and your personal account in a file that says, rip this guy off whenever you can, in a blue file in the right hand. That's, you know, and I just don't think that's something that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So the results of this Labor Department standard, and Vanguard has said some very good things about it. Most people in the industry are into this lawsuit thing or so on, but they're speaking, look, this is a great marketing business, the mutual fund business. I tried to make Vanguard a company that didn't wanted to make it a great fiduciary business, but it's a marketing business. And so that involves, you know, bringing out new funds that you would never bring out as fiduciary. It's because everybody seems to want them. And charging as much as you can so you can have the resources to bring out the next one and the next one. So this is an industry that is crying out for change. It doesn't know it is, but it's going to happen. And this fiduciary duty standard from DOL is probably a good turning point. And it's certainly got plenty of press. The public is more and more aware of it. And so I've been in favor of it all along. I actually worked a little bit with the Labor Department and the White House actually in the beginning, and did my best to help out along the way. I think they found that kind of surprising. But I guess what I do is kind of surprising to everybody.
Let me ask you, you've been talking to a lot of people about this, no doubt. And I'm thinking more in terms of the mass audience here, the retail investors. Have you detected any sort of response from them with regards to this DOL rule? Are they even aware of it? And what part about it do they remember?
I honestly believe that public awareness about the fiduciary standard is extremely low. It's not a high headline kind of thing. You know, we consumers here in the great United States of America have so many things on our mind. We worry about our jobs. We worry about our children. Am I paying my mortgage? All those kind of things that interfere with, you know, a wide view of the world, mean that unless something is really sensational, I mean, think of the difference between this, for example, what went on in Orlando, which is on television. I mean, the big thing, the slaughter,
right,
on television all the time, without any new news at all, and you can't miss that. This is easy to miss, but but sooner or later, your own experience as an investor is going to cause you to say, you know, and I hear this from investors every day, not about the fiduciary standard, but I used to be with blank, blank, and blank brokerage firm, and the best day of my life was the day I walked out on them and sent my money to you. I've probably got hundreds of letters that say that. So investor experience is going to be more important than the knowledge that there's a change in the weather in terms of fiduciary standards, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, you make me think of the big barrier to that, and I 100% agree with you, but the big barrier is the SEC's prohibition against the use of testimonials. And what you're talking about, I could see the ad on TV, but it can't be used by the industry, or you know, so for example, Vanguard can't use it, but somebody like the Fiduciary Institute, they could probably use it. I'm digressing when I'm talking about this.
When you talk about testimonials.
Well, what you just
talking about that papers with a financial orientation, New York Times, Wall Street Journal.
Right.
You know, I don't think the Philadelphia Inquirer is going to run one. So I think testimonials have a very limited impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people have thought it was so clever to use Don Knotts or somebody with Peter Lynch,
oh,
or whoever else it was, and that didn't do any good to Fidelity. Probably make them look a little bit like a joke.
Speaking of jokes, did you see that John Oliver show?
I have not seen it. Someone told me to start it 11 minutes, but I haven't gotten around. I've had kind of busy times here, much more than you would think.
I believe you.
Years old.
Yeah, it's about 19 minutes. They sent me over the tape. Well, it's on YouTube, so you could just search it and see. But I really liked it. I think that it went a long way towards bringing up the whole fiduciary problem to the forefront. Now, of that 19 minutes, it only spent maybe 3 minutes on fiduciary. So when I talked to people afterwards, they really came away with something totally different. They came away with the issue of high fees. And, you know, which is, they did it very well, very visually. But I thought that was a step in the right direction. I don't know. I mean, that. At some point, watch it, and I'd be curious to hear if you agree.
I can tell you a very similar experience was that public broadcasting piece on retirement plans about 3 years ago.
Right.
And then it runs again and again and again, and they had me at my best on that. I mean, I was, you know, just telling people what it is, and the guy, they brought in a guy from J.P. Morgan Funds, and he embarrassed himself.
Mm-hmm.
The head of the Prudential Funds, chairman, I guess, of the Prudential Fund Management Company, had the temerity to tell the announcer, he said, what about these comparisons that show that indexing beats active management? She said, I've never seen a comparison like that. She'd never seen a comparison like that? Are you kidding me?
I
either got to be the biggest moron in the world,
yeah,
or
that,
a liar. I don't know which.
She lost all credibility when she said that. I mean, that's kind of, which actually you bring up another thing. There was a question at the Philadelphia meeting there at the end where someone asked about passive versus active, and I don't really remember what the question was, but that's not important. What was more important was something that you said that I thought was really interesting, and that it was that you thought that the passive funds would only get about 50% of the market, and then you said that under some circumstances it would be appropriate to go to active, and then I don't know if you saw this week there were several articles that actually echoed that same thing. I think there was a conference with Morningstar. Could you?
No, I haven't looked at that either. You know, I got so much to read, Chris.
Oh, I know. Well, I'm just bringing it up to point out that people are saying the same thing you're saying, and they're writing about it. But I wanted to know if you could elaborate more on you know, what you meant under, when you said active funds were okay in certain circumstances, what you meant by that. Were you talking more about, you know, how there are some studies that show active trails in down markets? Are you talking more about the studies that would indicate that it's really the high fee funds, the ones with the conflicts of interest on the active side, which present the most problems? Or you didn't really explain that in Philadelphia, and I was wondering if you could kind of talk more about that now.
Well, the reality is that the victory of indexing is almost entirely a victory of cost, low cost. Because not only low advisory fees, low expense ratios, but don't forget, no portfolio turnover of any substance. And don't forget high tax efficiency, so they're much lower tax costs.
Right.
And so there's no reason an active fund can't try and duplicate that. It requires them to cut their advisory fees and reduce their transaction costs, start to take taxes into account in their investment decisions, and so they can be much more competitive than they are. Mm-hmm. It would mean if the chances right now of picking a winning fund over a decade is, let me say, just for the heck of it, I don't have a good number here for you, because funds go out of business so often. Often it's hard to do. I mean, half of the funds go out of business every decade. And the average portfolio manager only lasts 8 years anyway. So if you're investing for a lifetime, there's absolutely no question whatsoever that a low-cost index fund, which will have the same non-portfolio manager when you're 20 years old as the same non-portfolio manager you will have when you're 80 years old. Think about that one for a minute.
Right.
No new brooms to sweep clean as the old guys come and go. Yeah. And so a fund that tries to operate in accordance with those principles is going to do better than one that does not. It would be a real push to say that there's a way to buy a fund for which you're going to invest for a lifetime.
Right.
You know, there's too much change, too many come and go. Too many portfolio managers go, what is the fund without the portfolio manager in that kind of case?
Right.
You have to rely on those four principles of cost reduction, which are operating expenses, no advisory fees, taxes, and portfolio turnover. So those are the pillars.
Mm-hmm.
If someone observed them, they would have a fighting chance to win, but not over a lifetime. And when you say actively managed funds can win in a downturn, well, it would be astonishing if they couldn't, because they carry mutual funds. Most active funds carry a cash position of, you know, they used to be much larger, 8, 10, 12, 14%.
Right.
But in recent years, it's been more like 3 or 4%.
Right.
That helps them a little bit in a downturn. And then the index fund, if the downturn is a month, let's say, your savings are not 200 basis points a year, because it's only a month.
Right.
So it's 12 into 200.
Yeah. You know, I was reading something about an old mutual fund, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name, but they were doing exactly what you said. It's an actively managed fund. It's been around for maybe 85 years or so, but it's essentially buy and hold. So there's not a lot of turnover, and they must have low, I didn't look deeply, they must have low cost, but I think, I'll have to look at it and see, now that you mentioned those criteria, to see how well that fund matches against it, more because I'm curious than anything else. Let me ask you one more question, because I know you got to...
Let me go ahead.
Sure.
In one of my books, called one of my speeches now in a book, I think it's in, Clash of the Cultures, in Don't Count on It.
Right.
It has the Alpha Fund, the original mutual fund type, compared to the Omega Fund, the final type,
right,
the index fund. And I do the perfect example is, I think, the one you're citing, and that's Mass Investors Trust. It started in 1924.
Yes, that's it.
Probably in the market of, it looks like a Dow Jones average or something, the S&P average index. And it doesn't lose by very much, maybe a point a year. Very good. When you look at it over its lifetime, 85 or now 90 years, 92 years, I guess it is. It started in 1924, so you'll have to do the subtraction for me.
Right.
Its return is about half after the markets return in that period.
Mm-hmm.
But those little differences in cost over the fund's long, long, long lifetime just eat away at your return so gradually. It's like the Chinese water torture.
Yep.
You know, just a little bit at a time. So that's the example. It's in that book. Don't count on it.
Okay.
Alpha and Omega, it's called.
I'll take a look at it. Let me ask one more question. It's back to the retirement topic, and this one actually is something that I'm writing another story on, so I just wanted your take on it. I'm writing a story about parents who established IRAs for their kids, and I'm calling it a child IRA. It's a term that I made up. It's not a real name or anything, but it's easier for people to understand what I'm talking about when I say child IRA. I did some numbers, and if a parent donated $1,000 a year, or if a child established an IRA, $1,000 a year until they turn 19 from the moment they're born, and don't put anything else in there, it grows to $2.25 million when they retire at age 70. So I just was wondering if you had some general thoughts or comments on that, just the whole idea and the concept. The purpose of my article is actually to try to identify the types of jobs a newborn baby could do. There aren't many. So don't worry about that. Just the whole idea of the power of compounding, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, sure it is. As I was saying to a group the other day, people have to, and I've had this statement, and maybe it belongs to somebody else too, of time is your friend, impulse is your enemy. And if you just look at, let me draw a little chart in front of your eyes.
Okay.
Listen, if you start at age 1 or 0, just as you're born, and take that curve out to, say, 85 or whatever you want to do, probably 90 is a better one, and or maybe to your retirement age, say 65 or 70, and there's this slope, like a 45-degree slope on that line as it builds.
Right.
If you start when you're 50, that slope is almost straight up.
Right.
In other words, you've got to have, you might want to contrast $1,000 with, let's say, 65 years, with, let's say, $5,000 for 40 years, and God knows what it would be for 10 years.
Yep.
In other words, the steeper the slope, and the longer you wait, the steeper the slope. It's pretty easy to visualize.
I actually used that exact example almost, early Earl and late Larry, that's what I call him, in this book I wrote a couple years ago called Hey, What's My Number?
So you're right. The only thing, you know, what I've always said about Vanguard is what we do is give you the advantage of long-term compounding of returns without the tyranny of long-term compounding of costs. And that's what it's all about. You don't want to get eaten alive by expenses, and the longer you go, the worse it is. So if we can get that point across, you know, we have a logical, index funds are the only funds in the world where you can predict with high accuracy how they'll do relative to the market in the next 25 years. Nobody else has any idea. Nobody else has any idea whether they'll survive or not.
Mm-hmm.
Most don't.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good talking to you, Chris.
Yep, bye.